Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the Pro Wrestling Quiz Show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill 3 contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to Those Days, a Michinoku Pro Retrospective. Episode 7, Thunderstruck. Those Days is brought to you by Open the Voice Gate and the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You could find Those Days and Open the Voice Gate on the Voices of Wrestling podcast feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow Open the Voice Gate on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes and I'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast. You can set up a one-time or recurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside, as always, Case Lowe. In case it's been, if you're keeping up with Those Days as we are releasing, it's been a little bit of time since the last episode, but we're getting into this really fun period of Michinoku Pro, but before we get into where we are right now, Michinoku Pro, let's do a quick little recap on where we left things off at in episode 6.
I'm gonna give you a chance to take this and run with it if you want. We try to keep these episodes as evergreen as humanly possible because I do like the idea of somebody listening to this years from now. But Mike, we are recording this on the day that Hulk Hogan passed away.
Yeah, we are.
You lived in Florida for a number of years, so I'm sure Hulk Hogan was somewhat of a mentor towards you. I know you've
naturally
always said,
yes.
I know you've always said you weren't a fan of his in-ring work, but God love him. You know, you liked him as a person. Any thoughts on
and
the
his
Hulkster?
Business acumen?
Well, of course, he got the, you know, before he passed, he got the Fox Nation deal with the with the freestyle wrestling deal. You know, he was working. Did you see the tweet that Jimmy Hart sent out last night? Did you see Jimmy?
Oh yeah, about
tweet?
Him doing karaoke. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
What is that?
I mean, Hogan was Jimmy Hart's last, like, money train. Like, the ultimate money train. Like, what has Jimmy Hart done since 1993, really?
But you would hope, and I guess, I don't know, maybe this is a bad way to look at life, but you think about what Jimmy Hart has done and what he's been involved with and the Legends sure. contracts that he would have signed at some point. You would hope that Jimmy Hart, at this point in time, would just be able to sit on a lazy boy and go, great, I have enough money for the rest of my life. I don't need to grift with Hulk Hogan anymore.
I just think like that's a Memphis hustler. Like, you're kind of built on that. But yeah, because like you would think that Jimmy Hart like would be the kind of person that would have like the plush deal. And then whenever, I don't know who does WWE music now, but whenever Mikey Ruckus wanted to do something a little special, maybe you bring in Uncle Jimmy, you know, like that's kind of where you would think he would be. But no, he's till till the grave at that teat of Hulk Hogan, you know? So, I mean, it's just, it's wild, but also at the same time, you have him doing that. And the one person who's been going Hulk Hogan was on his deathbed was Bubba the Love Sponge.
Shout out, Bubba. Look, I've always said shock jocks are reliable journalists.
Yeah. As someone who's very well inundated and as I'm becoming increasingly aware, you are a Lance Corporal in Bubba's army. you should, like, I mean, this is like your good night and good luck era happening right here.
My muse, my light, my muse, my everything, Bubba the Love Sponge. I definitely model what I do for a living after Bubba.
you might be under the guise of Man Cow, but don't get it twisted. K-Slow is a Bubba the Love Sponge man. Yeah, like this is like the wild one where I feel like society has kind of already made their judgment on the guy in its way, you know, because his last television appearance, he's booed out of the building. And even in whatever you want to call the culture of 2025, it was like the one person that everyone's like, no, we're not going to let him back in with us. So it's kind of wild that like that's the last moment that most people did when you look at the person who, with the exception of just like the people who are on Mount Rushmore, is the most important person in the history of the wrestling industry outside of another tarnished person in Vince McMahon. It's kind of ironic the two of them going out these kinds of ways, you know?
Yeah. I do love that his last public appearance was a complete failure. I think that's very funny. I think it's weird that he's one of the most recognizable Americans to ever live. I was thinking about that earlier today.
No, easily. Like, I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility that after you get past your Michael Jordans and Michael Jacksons, Hulk Hogan's probably up on that list.
Yeah, he's probably tier two behind Elvis, Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson. I feel like people could pick Hulk Hogan out of a lineup in the same way they could pick Tiger Woods out of a lineup. You know, it's just very strange.
Right. I mean, the one professional wrestler that you would get a New York Times alert about.
Yeah. That's a good way of looking at it.
And that's kind of where I settle at with Hulk Hogan. He kind of is that like figure of yore that just did not leave the public eye. And that teaches you like the big thing about pop culture and like that kind of thing of in generations past, that's a figure who would have drifted away a long time ago.
He's just so funny to me because I am the age that I am. And so I have zero nostalgia for him. You know,
I'm very similar, even at my age. I was a WWF Attitude kid. I had no exposure to Hulk Hogan.
Okay. Really. Interesting. Yeah. I guess I've never thought about that, but that would also fit into your ballpark. Because the only thing that I watched of him when I was a kid was I had the SummerSlam DVD that had him and Shawn. And that was always like the least interesting thing on the show to me. So,
which is the uniquely K-Slow versus Mike Spears mindset? Because to me, Sean selling for Hulk Hogan is the most interesting thing on that show.
It rocks now, but there's like a sneaky good JBL Batista match on that show. There's a Matt Hardy Edge worked shoot where Hardy gets busted open really, really bad.
Oh, that's right. That's Angelic Diablo era. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's like a Benoit Orlando Jordan squash where Benoit wins back the U.S. title in 30 seconds. And that's really fun. I'm trying to think what else. God, I know this is the Mitch Doku Pro Retrospective podcast. I apologize to everybody. I do have to look at the SummerSlam 2005 card real quick now because I really wore out this DVD.
For the record, no one on their Those Days bingo card had the first cage match reference being SummerSlam 2006.
I knew Ray did something good on this show. Okay, so it was Benoit Orlando Jordan, which went 26 seconds. It was Edge versus Matt Hardy, where Edge won via referee's decision in 4 minutes. And then it was the custody of Dominic ladder match with Ray.
That's right,
and Eddie. Jeez. Yes. And then Kurt Angle versus Eugene, where apparently Eugene was seconded by Christy Hemme, which I don't remember. Randy Orton versus The Undertaker.
Oh yeah, like Christy was like the girl that, at least for like every time period with Eugene, like there was always like the damsel that became attached to him, right? And she was that for that time period.
I don't know. I
mean, that's just how WWE booked. That's not me making any sort of gender comments. That's literally how they did that back in those days. I think also like Joy Giovanni was a part of the storyline at one point.
Yeah, I'm sure that all ages really, really well. And then there was an Orton Undertaker match. I think this is where Bob Orton debuted because the finish was. I remember this. I hate that I know this because the Orton Undertaker WrestleMania match is actually really good for Orton and Undertaker. But then the finish to this match is Bob Orton comes out in face makeup. So he's old, but he looks like an even older man who stumbles ringside.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And
then like he peels off it and it's like, that's Bob Orton. And no one knows who Bob Orton Sr. is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he bleeds his hepatitis blood on Undertaker 3 months later, and that's the end of that. And then there was
I forgot about the hepatitis thing. WWE 2006, like we talk about like those peak years of Dragon Gate, but 2018 and 2006 WWE, you know, I mean they kind of had in certain ways they had other they commiserated in misery a lot.
It's unbelievable. And then there was Cena versus Jericho, and then Jericho left the next night, and then Batista versus JBL, and then Hogan versus Michaels. But I'm not a product of the 80s, and I really loathe 80s nostalgia, and I don't care about Hogan's 90s stuff outside of the cage match that he has with Flair and WCW that I think is a bizarrely great match. And then it's not like I'm nostalgic about like the Hogan and Edge tag team in 2002 or anything. So he's always been a caricature of my least favorite parts of pro wrestling. And so, tomorrow I'm sure I'll have a number of discussions with people who know that I like wrestling, and they're going to ask me my opinions about Hulk Hogan. And I'm going to go, well, you know, giant racist and also not any good. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, no, this is like one of those like things that I think if you're listening to this podcast, you probably encounter it in your life too, that this is the kind of guy that all of your non-wrestling people in your lives would be like, oh yeah, Hulk Hogan, and you're like, yeah.
But it'll be the same thing when Vince dies, where people are going to go like, oh my god, aren't you sad he created this thing that you love? And I'm like, no, I actually think he made this thing worse.
Yeah, and his dad basically set him up for it, and the hagiography is the thing that should be studied from him, not anything about his business acumen, if you ask me.
Speaking of business acumen, great Sasuke, Michinoku Pro 1994, doing pretty well for themselves at this point.
Yeah, I mean, so 1994, in our last episode, we were talking about the big UWA reunion and Sasuke being at a point where literally the tour is, how about that great Sasuke? And coming off a peak where New Japan is deeply basing their junior heavyweight division led by Jushin Thunder Liger with a strong undercurrent of Michinoku Pro stars at this point. And lo and behold, you have a show that is the UWA reunion where Ultimo Dragon makes an appearance in Yahaba on July 30th. I believe those were our big moments from it. Oh, yeah.
Sasuke acted like he was going to retire. Ultimo Dragon showed up. Jinsei Shinzaki worked 1-2-3 Kid on the WWF Japan tour, which we went pretty in-depth on last time. And it was made very clear that Shinzaki's days in Michinoku Pro were numbered. So we left off on July 30th, 1994, about 18 months into the existence of Michinoku Pro. On this episode, episode 7 of Those Days, Thunderstruck, we will go through the two Michinoku Pro TV shows in September of 1994 and the Great Sasuke's appearance in the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Tag League Finals in October of 1994. The next episode will be a loaded one as we break down Sasuke versus Onita and then the two TVs that we have from December of 1994, one of which features an absolute personal favorite of mine, a Sasuke versus Taka Michinoku match that I really, really can't wait to rewatch. I don't know if I've seen it in 10 years, but I remember watching that match for the first time and loving it. We'll talk about that more then, because we have to jump into the timeline for, I guess, let me say this before we jump into the timeline. Would you say off the bat, Mike, that if 1993 as a whole represents one era in Michinoku Pro, and really you can extend that through February of 94, with the Cork and Hall debut, and then you have a changing of the guard and a change in promotion and tone with Sasuke doing the J Cup and the success that comes from that. And as I mentioned last time around, that the July 30th, 1994 show, it felt like we were seeing the foundation of what we recognize as peak Michinoku Pro between the crowd and the wrestlers and the overall package and production. That felt like the Michinoku Pro that people really love and remember. It feels like we're entering a new era given what we saw on these shows. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, and we've gone 13 minutes before kind of beating around the bush. This ends up being, this episode is the launch of the unit that becomes synonymous with Michinoku Pro. Like, from here on in, we will have Kai and Tai in the promotion at least through its peak, and we'll talk about the departures thereof, but we're absolutely in a new era. And I don't know how you would really carve out like how the company was with like 1993 with like Onita and that relationship, and then quickly veering into the New Japan relationship, the Super J Cup as you laid it out here. But this is absolutely the start of a new thing, and it starts really right on Champ Forum immediately with the three guys who would form Kai and Tai.
Before we get there, we have to jump to the Wrestling Observer newsletter. This comes from August 22nd, 1994, in which Dave writes that Great Sasuke, on August 19th, will become the first wrestler to appear on All Night Nippon, a late-night talk show equivalent to David Letterman in the U.S. He also notes that Michinoku Pro performed before its largest crowd to date on 8-9 in Niigata, a 6,500-person free outdoor festival show that was headlined by Sasuke, Sato, and Paleto Suicida against Grand Nanawa, Superboy, and Super Delphin. I'm absolutely devastated we do not have that on tape. I will continue with this quick note of the timeline before you jump back in, Mike. On August 29th, 1994, The Observer, as part of Nippon TV's 24-hour telethon this past weekend, Michinoku Pro ran a free live show, which drew 4,500 fans on 8/21. Great Sasuke was all over the telethon, and Sasuke and Super Delphin answered fans' questions from the ring before they put on a three-match card. So we see two separate occasions here where Sasuke is not even doing regionalized press in the same way that he would have done so in 1993. We've now entered this weird period where Sasuke is a fringe Japanese celebrity? Is that the fair way to assess this?
I would say that that's a maybe a little bit downgrading it, like, to a level. So All Night Nippon, the radio show, this is a really interesting link to previous episodes of those days. This was the show that Beat Takeshi was on, a part of Takeshi Puroresu Gundam. So this is kind of harkening back to that when they were doing like those radio shows and like this, and there's the TV live component. And I think that's what Dave's is talking about, him appearing and being the first wrestler in the TV component. But Sasuke very quickly goes from being this figure in just the Japanese wrestling press. And I think it's really, you could trace that all the way back to him and Wally Yamaguchi back in 92. Trying to create this kind of mystique and like, we're doing this, and the way that they've always been media gadflies, at least Sasuke, just given where he was in April, it makes complete natural sense that he would already be like a fringe celebrity and be appearing on telethons and stuff like this. And that's very much within like the popular culture of that time period too. Like, this is right before cellular devices and internet really take over and divert entertainment in Japan. Like, but just because like the cellular networks pop up a lot sooner than they did in the States. So he really is kind of getting in on this at like a key moment before it would go away pretty soon, which I find kind of interesting.
It's a shame we never got a Sasuke running on the Larry Sanders show. I feel like,
oh my God,
I feel like the
him
chemistry
and Hank
between
Kingsley.
Oh my God. I was thinking Shandling, but you're right. I mean, even he and Hank together, that feel, do you remember? Look, there's let me preface with, we have less footage to watch than we normally do, so I'm going to go on a few diatribes here. Do you remember, cuz I feel like you might, cuz your brother's in the comedy world, there was the website Splitsider, and like 12
oh,
years
yeah, ago, absolutely.
Like 12 yeah. years ago, they published the Seinfeld 9/11 spec script, and the guy that wrote that ended up getting hired on Family Guy. Do you remember that story?
Yes. Yes. Because I was like, I'm trying to remember what the message board that was a part of that community too, that was really connected to Jimmy Pardo at that time.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I don't remember what that was called, but I know what you're talking about. And so for those that don't know, there was a website called Splitsider, which was a phenomenal, phenomenal site that acted as comedy journalism, but all, it was, you know, it had the tone of like the AV Club, but it also could dive deep on stories if they needed to. Really, really valuable website that eventually got folded into Vulture and just it was never the same after that. But a guy wrote a spec script for what a Seinfeld post 9/11 episode would have looked like. It was absolutely hilarious. It was so well done. That got passed around the internet. That guy ended up with a writing job for Family Guy. And now all I can think of with the limited free time that I have is that I should be writing a Larry Sanders Show spec script where one of the guests is the great Sasuke.
A special thing was the message board.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I haven't thought about that in a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a message board that's died a decade ago, if you think about it. Yeah.
Yes. But Sasuke is on the rise. And I think that's worth noting that now we're talking about, you know, not Northeastern Japan regional stuff, but we're talking about him as a national star. There's a lot more of that as we get throughout 94 and then into 95. There's just some interesting notes as to where Sasuke falls in the pecking order of the Japanese wrestling hierarchy, you know, in a time with Inoki and Hashimoto and Muto and Misawa and Kobashi. You'll see Sasuke's name pop up there, which I think is really interesting. We also have this note from the Observer. This is August 22nd, 1994. I just love this writing from Dave. Sasuke's rival Super Delphin now has a new nickname on all his merchandise, Mr. Perfect. What an original idea. I can't imagine where he ever came up with that.
Well, Dave, first off, mean. Second off, it's Senor Perfecto, and that's completely different than Kurt Hennig.
And Senor Perfecto sounds so unbelievably cool.
I mean, he's Senior Perfecto. Like, it makes perfect sense. Like, you could hear him being called Senior Perfecto and raising his arms like Sasuke does, or like Delphin does.
Absolutely. No, I love it so much. Dave would continue. This is from September 5th, 1994, in which he notes, and this is important because this match listing will change not once, but twice as we go throughout this timeline. But on September 5th, 1994, in the Observer, Dave notes that Michinoku Pro has the biggest match in its history on September 29th, as Jushin Thunder Liger comes in to wrestle Great Sasuke. Now, remember that, because even before we get to the massive Liger portion of these notes, that match listing will change.
Yeah, and this would be... I really should be keeping track each episode which time Dave says Michinoku Pro is having now the biggest match in its history, because that's at least the fifth time he's called it that.
On September 19th, 1994, in The Observer, we go to the New Japan section as we continue to see a prosperous relationship between Michinoku Pro and New Japan Pro Wrestling. New Japan announced two tag team tournaments during October from 10-9 to 10-18 with the finals in Okayama. They'll do the first ever Super Great Tag League Junior Heavyweight Division tournament with Jushin Thunder Liger and Black Tiger, Shinjiro Otani and Wild Pegasus, El Samurai and Two Cold Scorpio, Tokumitsu Ishizawa and Dean Malenko, Gran Hamada and Norio Hanagawa, Super Delphin and Taka Michinoku, Yuki Ishikawa and Soshi Funaki, and Masayoshi Motegi and Kamikaze from the Social Pro Wrestling Federation. Mike, on paper, one of the more impressive tournament lineups you'll ever see.
Yeah, and also the question of who is the number two guy in Social Pro Wrestling Federation, you know?
Everybody was concerned with when that lineup got announced.
Hey, I'm also the person who is privately tracking what Gayora has as sports licensing during 1994. So,
was a great one in here. This actually works out nice because the next thing in our timeline is the September 15th, 1994 TV. During this TV that we're about to break down, did you see that Gayora ran a commercial for Pac-10 basketball?
Not only I had to make sure friend of the show and everyone, Alan Forwell, knew about it immediately because we've been talking about the World Cup ads. And then on the 929 show, because I had the DVD of it, I have a whole bunch of Gaura NFL 1994 commercials with like Larry Woodson and Troy Aikman. It's great. And
it's so good.
There was a Aussie Rules football commercial that was at the end of one of them that was played to Rump Shakers. Because I haven't been able to get the preview and stuff like that done, I might just throw that up there as our preview for this episode, just because it's so bewildering.
I know that if you're somebody who worked for Gaiora in 1994, you'd be like, well, this is just Michinoku Pro Wrestling. There's no way that two white dudes 30 years from now are going to be doing a radio show in which they break down all of this footage. But by the same coin, I can't imagine working for Gaiora in 1994 and being like, we have to acquire Pac-10 basketball rights. Somebody has to see the beginning of Mike Bibby's collegiate career. You know what I mean? Like, bizarre. It's not even like ACC or Big East basketball. It's Pac-10.
Yeah, like, I really have to. It's a situation where, like, if you're the international, like, rights sellers of these things, you're just trying to get any money whatsoever.
How does that conversation even begin? Because,
hey, you need a 3-hour block filled? Well, I have for you Oregon Ducks basketball.
I guess. I feel like we could have gotten more Michinoku Pro footage instead of that. But
Gaiora 1994, as like a sports fan, like objectively, they have the World Cup, they have Pac-10 basketball, they have the NFL, they have F1. Man, if I am living in Tokyo in 1994, I know that cable is kind of a luxury, but man, Gaiora kind of had a little bit of everything at that point. Michinoku Pro too.
I'm with you there. I still think about the highly specialized cable channels of the 2000s, like Fuel TV, where it's just like, oh yeah, we're just going to do a bunch of skateboarding documentaries every day. And it was a great channel. I miss it tremendously to this day.
Hey, I was of the generation that Tech TV, then later G4, was really formative.
And
so
we just missed out on Dragon Gate on G4.
Yeah, I mean, God, we were so close on that. That could have been a thing. But yeah, no, like the footage we have on this episode, we could have gone through all the touring notes, but basically they are running as much as they really ever will during this time period. And just because of how Gaiora works, all we have is these over this time period. The first part of the first champ forum that has 9:15 is still recapping stuff from the show that Ultimo did in Yahaba in the July. We only really have these three shows. And when we talk about 9:29, there's a little bit of, oh, we had 2-hour blocks that we gave you. We had to edit around the show so it looked like an hour of wrestling TV and not a wrestling show that was cut to 2 hours, 2-hour shows.
Yes. Yeah. So as for the September 15th, 1994 show, we have an hour of new footage, and I was saying this to you before we started recording, I think it's worth reiterating here. One of the most effective hours of TV that I can remember seeing in wrestling. Whereas, you know, in the last episode, we praised the high level of wrestling from, say, the Taka versus Jado match or the Michinoku Pro versus New Japan 8-man tag from that show, or even, you know, something like Shinzaki versus 1-2-3 Kid that was a borderline great match. This show does not have anything that I think would appeal to the notebook chasing Michinoku Pro rewatch style, which, if that's what you're doing, more power to you, because that's awesome and we should all be watching all of the great Michinoku Pro matches. I think 9:15-94 is the first thing that we've really come across where it is best consumed sitting down from start to finish and not just jumping to what's Dick Togo doing or what's Sasuke doing or what's Delphin doing or what's Shinzaki doing, whoever your guy may be on the roster. This is just a phenomenal TV episode.
Yeah, and I think that the thing that makes it really kind of rewarding, at least as of this hour, if you've been following along with the footage, you have seen all of the cards kind of be laid out for this all to happen and to encapsulate and end with like the first time that Sato really gets one over on Delphin and leading him to the point that you have, perhaps outside of like the Tarzan, Goto and Otani appearances, one of the most savage matches in the company's history. And by the end of it, it's real interesting because my big takeaway from these two shows were I'm so excited for the first time to see the three of Kai and Tai, which we should probably say at this time. Kai and Tai forms on September 15th, 1994. On the TV show, they start the portion of the show with them introducing themselves as Kai and Tai, and they're kind of playing a little bit to the camera, a little bit as face. And then you have a match with Terry Boy versus Jinsei Senzaki, which although Terry Boy is putting up more of a fight, it is not like absolute destruction. But the tag match, by the end of that, you go, well, by themselves, these are still kind of the three guys and where they are. But my God, whenever you see Sato team with Shiryu in that main event, and then on the next show, Sato with a Terry Boy in the opener, it's a completely different animal that is now in Michinoku Pro. And the company's completely now changed now that there is this third group that is going right at Delphin Corps from the start.
And I think one of the benefits of doing a rewatch project versus, say, you know, breaking down Dragon Gate in real time as you and I do almost every week is that we now have the benefit of hindsight and we know what the next chapters are in this story. One of the things that is most interesting to me about the introduction of Kai and Tai is something happens between May of 1994 and September of 1994, which is a 5-month period. It's a long time, but it becomes apparent that Senzaki is not long for the world of Michinoku Pro, and they are so proactive in getting Kai and Tai over and establishing them on this show, on the next show, on the October 30th show with Sasuke and Onita that we'll talk about next time, and then so on and so forth as we go along, because the evolution of Kai and Tai is great and it shapes the promotion. And the funny thing is, we know this now because of the benefit of hindsight and because I've done the notes on all these episodes. When Kai and Tai is leaving, much like Senzaki did years earlier, they are not proactive at all. They actually are incredibly slow to adapt and react. And the story of Michinoku Pro is likely a far bleaker one, a death possibly, if it isn't for the fact that Ultimo Dragon just happened to start a wrestling school in Mexico and needed to find work for his kids. Because there's a period post Kai and Tai pre Crazy Max where those Michinoku Pro cards are not exactly the most exciting things on the planet. The only way they're able to adapt post Kai and Tai is just by plucking Crazy Max out of thin air and letting these God-given prodigies be prodigies in Michinoku Pro. It's very funny to me that happened.
Yeah, and then you see, as soon as Toriumon is launched, everyone who's still left over, and we're not necessarily giving up the ghost by saying this, they very quickly leave Sasuke right afterwards. So it basically just plugs the gap for 9 months, essentially.
Yes, exactly. So this September 15th, 1994 show, we begin with Senzaki versus Terry Boy. And Mike, I regret to inform you that these guys have done it again. They had such a great match in July of 1993, and I have just completely fallen in love with their chemistry.
And it's a completely different match they have here.
It's a completely different match. With the root of it still being that Terry Boy is getting his shit rocked, but it's done in a different way than it was a year prior.
Yeah, whereas at Mockland, Terry Boy was immediately dumped to the outside and then went through hell for 10 minutes. He had a strategy they kept on going back to. He was kept on going for the armbar and was able to step up and brawl with Senzaki when they went to the outside. But it still was a little bit of a fait accompli. You do have like this interesting aspect of Senzaki between this show and then also in Amori, where he is invincibility, I guess, because we've never really like have had a term to describe like the idea that Senzaki does not sell other than his pilgrim. Like he's religiously like and karmically attuned, so he's not he does not like sell as much. He sells a whole lot in both this and then the match we'll talk about later against Shiryu, and it's like really kind of stark because outside of matches in FMW or the Oda Ward Gymnasium match against Great Sasuke, you don't get that with him at all. So that is kind of a stark thing that happens in this match that is notable, especially in comparison to the first half dozen episodes of those days.
The blood that comes from Terry Boy's head and really right above his right above his eye is pretty startling in this match. It feels like
it almost looks like his eye gets gouged.
Yeah, it really, if you take out the Onita stuff, this is the most violent Michinoku Pro on Michinoku Pro thing that we've seen so far. And Shinzaki continues to be the guy whose stock I'm most impressed with, because Terry Boy is great at working underneath. I specifically like Terry's making a comeback in this match, and he just keeps on doing these step-up enziguris on Shinzaki that remind me.
Right.
That, I mean, it's a Kawada move is what he's doing. You know, he's taking a page out of the Kawada playbook, and I really liked the way that he delivered that offense in the way that Shinzaki very slowly sold it. And you start to see as the match went on that Shinzaki was okay taking more and more offense. But it's just, these guys have magical chemistry, which I was not expecting.
Yeah, and they have perhaps the best crowd brawl to the in the company to this point when you take between Michinoku Pro guys, I would say. Sorry, I phrased that awfully. But the Shinzaki and Terry Boy do this fight around Fukushima, where apparently there is this table tennis section and they get right on top of a ping pong table, and Terry does a pile driver into the ping pong table where it collapses because it's one of the foldable ones. And you just go like, wow, that looked really awesome. And then you had the moment where Shinzaki later, they fight up onto the balcony and he walks the balcony rail doing the prayer walk. And it is the, and maybe it's also the fact that the cameras are a little better than last year, since this isn't a commercial tape. And I thought that this, like the brawling in this match, was some blind stuff. It really the best stuff that the company has had. And you we've been kind of faced with all these Yoni Genjin versus Wellington Wilkins matches where they basically walk and brawl for 15 minutes, and it's just a breath of fresh air to have a really crisp, well-executed one that even at certain points does not become what the match is about. It just becomes like a chapter of it. I do have something in my notes case that I need just get your gut reaction real quick. Terry Boy is already wearing the Kai and Tai gear at this time where basically him and Shiryu copy Sato's tights, but they all have their own emblem on the front of it. And Terry has touched up his hair. In case, I have to ask you, doesn't Terry Boy look like modern Kazuma Sumi?
I did not put that together in real time, but I can certainly understand where you're coming from now that you say that. Yeah, that's a good comp.
It's the bleach hair and the tan with like those two. It just looks very much on it. But I adore this. Like, this is a series of matches that I know it's a shame that we're not, they had to say bye-bye for Shinzaki for a while, but I really hope we get more Terry Boy versus Jinsei Shinzaki. Not as good as the Mockland one, but it had a different element that I thought was really, really cool.
I think the great thing, you mentioned that ping pong table spot. I just have to clarify, you know, that is not played for laughs, which is really great. It's much like that other match where, again, if you liked what they did in July of 93, I think you have to go back and watch this just because it's a nice evolution where you can see in 1 year that Terry Boy has been elevated to a higher degree than he was at in 1993, but the violence and the chemistry is still there. And when they go throughout the arena, it really does have a certain zip and a certain amount of life to it, which is great to see. It's not comedic crowd brawling. It's not like what we talked about last time with Wilkins Jr. and some of these just endless crowd brawling spots with Yone Genjin. This felt like a fight all around the arena, which really helps in continuing to figure out what Kai and Tai is at this point.
Yeah, it very much felt like their brawls are like Tupelo concession stand brawls, whereas the other ones are like comedy matches.
Yes, yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
So Shinzaki wins this match. He is now 2-0 up on Terry Boyaf, and it just really worth going out of your way if you like the match they had at Mockland. Our next match case, we get Joined in Progress. This is for Sasuke's International Junior Heavyweight title versus Turako. He wins with the chicken face lock, and this kind of was the palate cleanser before the main event.
Yes, so Turako is Hysteria, who was a AAA guy from 1997 to 2009, not to be confused with Super Crazy, who I believe also worked under that name for a little bit.
Yep.
But, you know, ended up being a Peristyle Mall guy for a little bit, worked IWRG for a little bit, but that is sort of what he's known for. And here, you know, for as much as you and I waxed poetically about Superboy and Pileto Suicida and Kendo on the last episode and how we really feel like one of the unheralded aspects of Michinoku Pro around this time period is some of the luchadors that they used, I would say this is largely forgettable.
Yeah, I didn't bother rating it. Like, really, the one kind of notable kind of thing was that Sasuke was much more crisp in this match than he is against, like, people like Liger and Benoit. And, like, that is a thing that you kind of noticed throughout the shows. And especially more so, I would say, about that Mori show. I think all that working in New Japan and in that kind of environment kind of refines at least Sasuke a little bit at this point.
Oh, my God, yeah. It goes back to, if you want to go back to episode one, when he talked about how hard it was to improve because Universal just wouldn't run any shows, and he felt like he started to really improve as a wrestler when he went to Mexico and was working almost every day. You're now seeing, in the same way that we see with modern day Dragon Gate, just being on the road for 18 months is going to make you better. When you're on the road with Delphin, Shinzaki, and then Liger and Otani, you get even better as a result of that.
Yeah, I felt like that was the only thing I really took away from this. It just felt like, given like what the show was and where it was on tour, it gives you kind of, I think it's smart booking having a match like this, especially given what happened in Shinzaki and leading up to it. It just feels kind of stark there.
Yeah, it's clipped. It's whatever. It's a fine match.
Yeah, but the main event is the Delphin Corps of Taka Michinoku and Super Delphin versus Kai and Tai, Sato, and Shiryu. This match goes to a DQ because they attack Ted Tanabe. That brings out Terry Boy. They absolutely lay out Taka Michinoku, which brings out Sasuke chants, but the whole entire crowd kind of is starting to get behind Taka a little bit, but is more in shock because in this match, Kai and Tai take out Super Delphin with a spike pile driver from the apron to the floor. And after that, this match turns into an absolute just beat down on Taka. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought I'm already full on board on Kai and Tai as now the new heel unit after that, like that kind of match. I think this match is really important because Super Delphin and Delphin Corps are still going to kind of exist, but you needed to, on the first night, kind of put the stamp on, okay, these are now the big bads now.
Well, and especially as Taka slid into that role with Delphin and sort of bumped Shinzaki out of that universe into his own thing, we saw Delphin really play up being, I guess for lack of a better term, like a Ric Flair type heel, or a Mr. Perfect type heel, you know? He's there's an
obvious
cover there.
I mean, Senior Perfecto, but yes.
Yes, exactly. And you see with Kai and Tai just an immediate tonal change in the way that these heel units are presented that I think is absolutely necessary. You know, I think if Dick Togo was just going to try to one-up Delphin in the way that he was presented, I'm not sure this would have worked. But you see with the spike pile driver, the way that they sell it with Delphin getting carried off and then Delphin never coming back, you know, Delphin just being gone, it is very clear that Delphin is a cocky, suave heel, and Kai and Tai are killers. And I think they do just a brilliant job of displaying that in this match.
Yeah, absolutely. And Shiryu debuts his new heel mask, and the reaction from the crowd about his new mask was like a kind of cool after effect. And I think that that's a real important thing. Like, if we track the idea of that there's in a pro wrest or a lucha wrest promotion, the idea now that we have multiple factions and that really only one of them inhabits kind of a heel role, we're finally seeing like the first time of that kind of happening and seeing like Delphin Corps has changed so drastically over the last real year from where it was this time in 1993. Mr. Toyota has not been seen in 1994. I've been waiting. I've been kind of trying to see if there's something that in research about Wally Yamaguchi maybe having a falling out, but he's no longer a part of it. There's not as much like outright shenanigans with Delphin Corps. Delphin is still preening and being who he is, but it's become a little bit more of a grounded heel unit by this night, and it kind of by sanding down those thorny bits, those spiky bits on Delphincore, it kind of like presents it the perfect kind of scenario to have a new group just completely dismantle them and take the new big bad throne.
It's a shame, to my knowledge, that we don't really have a definitive Taka versus Dick Togo match, because their chemistry here is evident, and especially this young Taka, the way that he flies around the ring, then the obvious counter to that of just Dick Togo being a bowling ball and just swatting him out of the air on some of these planches is a really fun dynamic that they have. So you made the comparison earlier that Shinzaki versus Terry Boy felt like one of those concession stand brawls in Memphis. This is almost, I don't know what territory you would compare this to. Is this the closest Michinoku Pro ever got to like an episode of World Class TV?
I mean, if you want to like take it down to, all right, the dastardly heels isolate, take down the overwhelming baby face, the crowd super kind of reacts to it, and at least for like the weekly TV, the thing would be like you beat down Carrie or Kevin, and at the end of it they cut the promo saying that they're going to get their brothers and their friends, they're going to kick those they're going to kick their ass, like in that kind of archetype it is. But it does kind of in a same way still kind of feel Memphis more so, because I always kind of felt like that was World Class a little bit taking the studio aspect when they would do that on their TV shows. They would take the studio aspect from like Memphis or Georgia to do that.
Okay, yeah, that tracks then. That works for me. You would be the expert on that, so I will defer to you there, and I like that. But yeah, again, I mean, start to finish, it helps that we don't have the Hoshikawa Wilkins Jr. match, and we don't get the Nanawa Nakajima match, but you get those three matches there, one of which is clipped incredibly heavily. It's just a really enjoyable hour of pro wrestling.
And also, if you're watching all of the Michinoku Pro footage, you don't need to see another Wilkins match like that.
No, you know, you like do not.
You do not. And it really, I think for like this tour that they now like go on for, this is just a stop of the tour. They had shows basically every day in August, and then they could basically pick it up, and they basically from this show until the other one, they run every day except the 19th, and the 19th is the only day they have off between that.
That's incredible. That is.
Yeah,
really
I was going through the listing. I was going, okay, this is on 9/15. Nothing on 9/19, and I keep on going down. I go like 9/26. No, there's 9/26. 9/27. Yep. 9/28. Yeah. No. They wrestle for essentially 13 days straight. Oh, or 2 weeks straight.
That's nuts. And then you look at those shows, and this ties into the Observer note that I have here from September 26, 1994, in which Dave says that Michinoku Pro shot an angle where Shiryu, Sato, and Terry Boy formed their own trio called Heisei Kai and Tai, turning on Great Sasuke. So they now have three feuding groups with Sasuke's group, with Sato and Shiryu leaving. That moves Hanzo Nakajima up to main event status as Sasuke's partner. They have one of their biggest shows in their history on, Dave writes 9:30, but he means 10:30, on 10:30 in Iwate with Sasuke versus Atsushi Onita in an electrified dynamite match. So this is what's relevant here, is that when you look at the rest of this tour, every show is headlined by some combination, or almost every show is headlined by some combination of Sasuke and Hanzo Nakajima teaming together, which in 1993 felt completely impossible.
Yeah, I mean, just last episode, I was pointing out, oh, look at Hanzo Nakajima falling down the cards. But because of just the calculus and how small of a promotion this is, that he kind of has to be that person, because you look at the what exists of the babyface side of the roster, it's Wilkins and Hoshikawa who are usually having their own matches, or Yakushiji, who is usually on this tour in openers jobbing to people. So he really was like the last one up for him.
We get the note that nobody wanted on October 3rd, 1994 in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, in which Dave notes that Jushin Thunder Liger, who has been rated near or at the top of nearly everyone's list of the best wrestler in the world for the past 7 years, and considered by many as the greatest junior heavyweight pro wrestler of all time, suffered a badly broken left leg on 9/24 in Nagoya. Liger was wrestling in a rare main event for him, teaming with Riki Choshu against Kaiji Muto and Wild Pegasus before a sellout of 11,000 fans at Aichi Gym. It was a freak accident on a rather tame-looking high spot as Liger whipped Muto into the ropes and leapfrogged him, with Muto rolling under and coming back with a quick savate kick. Apparently, Liger's leg gave out on the landing, and he couldn't get up after he rolled out of the ring from the kick. After he laid there for a while, Hiroshi Hase and Takuya Izuka noticed something was wrong and came out with a stretcher to carry him from the ring. Photographers who went backstage noticed that his leg was all dark black, and he was immediately sent to the hospital, where the x-ray showed the badly broken left leg, and doctors said it would be 6 months to 1 year before he could return. The match itself continued as a singles match with Muto versus Choshu until finally Pegasus, who had left the ring to make it an even match, returned to the ring. Hase then came out in Choshu's corner wanting a tag, but Choshu never tagged out and eventually was pinned by Muto's moonsault. The next day, New Japan announced on 9/27 in Osaka, Liger's IWGP Junior Heavyweight title would be put at stake in a six-man one-night tournament with Gran Hamada, Shinjiro Otani, Pegasus, El Samurai, Black Tiger, and Norio Hanaga. And a major surprise, Hanaga, by far the least impressive wrestler of the six, pinned Hamada, who Dave notes was the pre-tournament favorite, Otani, and finally Wild Pegasus in the finals to capture the tournament. They also announced that Liger would have to cancel his appearances for Michinoku Pro, where the small regional outfit had a dream tag match of Liger and Sasuke versus Samurai and Super Delphin this week, and a Liger versus Sasuke singles match scheduled, with Hamada expected to be the replacement on both nights. I'm going to stop there briefly because Dave's writing confuses me. I never see an official listing of Liger being booked for two Michinoku Pro shows. I think originally he was booked for a singles match with Sasuke that then got turned into this tag match that then got turned into nothing. But I have not been able to find any record of Liger being booked twice for Michinoku Pro, just that one show.
Yeah, and given where they are running and where it was, it doesn't necessarily track that he would have been used for two shows, right? Because Amori is a place that they do run, but 1600 there tells me that this was like a planned, like a big show for them. I mean, and you look at how they structure their touring, this is after like that formal tour that they were running for two straight weeks, and this is its own thing itself. It's called the Junior Nobuta Show Festival. It's not the Lucha Hosomichi Tour Night 13 or Night 1 that was the case that we reviewed earlier. So I don't see credence, at least from the stuff that I've seen, that makes me think that this was going to be two appearances. I thought it was always going to be he went to Michinoku Pro to make up and do one match against Sasuke there. Like that was always kind of the impression, and at least with how things were being presented up to this point, to be one match, right?
That's my impression of it, and I think this is just a matter of things getting lost in translation. I feel what happened is they had a singles match booked. That singles match got turned into a tag match, and then Liger got hurt and he couldn't do the tag. That's my read of it.
Yeah. That definitely tracks. I don't think they actually, this building that they run for the, this is the Amori Prefectural Gym. They don't run this building before. So
okay,
that I think that tells us that this was going to be set up as a big show.
Yeah. So, well, they end up selling it out at 1681. So it ended up doing quite well for them. More in the Observer, but real quick before I get back to that, it's interesting to note here that when we began this series, we were looking at the crumbling of Universal, and I talked about how during the first few episodes of this podcast, and also that just happened to align with Hamada's passing, but you know, one of the tough things for Hamada at this point in time is that he's loyal to the UWA in Mexico, which is crumbling to the ground, and so he loses out on being able to jump to either CMLL or AAA. And then Universal in Japan is falling apart. And in 1993, it's looking like Hamada might just be done as a pro wrestler. You know, we read that note, I think it was two episodes ago, where Dave has in the Observer that Hamada is thinking about retiring. And we see, despite him not being in the J-Cup, which we we're led to believe that it's because he did not want to lose in the first round, that Hamada is brought into New Japan in 1994, and by the end of 94, is right there with Liger and Otani and Benoit and Eddie as a real push junior in New Japan, which seemed impossible at the start of this year.
Yeah, and especially when, like, you think about, you talk about his loyalty to UWA. UWA, although they officially close in 95, they're basically already dead. So he's been already spending the year stringing together whatever work he can get in Mexico in the fallout of UWA failing and there not being a third major promotion.
And
so,
this next note of the Observer ties into that because he ends up not working a ton of AAA, but it does become his spot in Mexico, which I believe, and please, if I'm wrong, somebody can correct me, but I think that comes through the New Japan partnership, because what happens is Dave writes, and this again is from the 10/3/94 Wrestling Observer newsletter, that Liger would also be out of the Super Grey Junior Heavyweight Tag Tournament, which he was also the top draw in, and that he would be replaced by the Great Sasuke. And then Dave continues, although nothing was officially announced, Liger will also be forced to miss another singles junior heavyweight tournament that he was scheduled to face several new opponents for, coinciding with the first AAA Japan tour scheduled from November 15th to November 24th. Sasuke ends up working a ton in that tour. We won't spend a ton of time on that, but that is a historic tour, a great tour. Sasuke works a lot there. Liger is supposed to be a huge part of it. Hamada is a huge part of that tour. And instead, we get no Liger.
Yeah, and talking about Hamada for a second, I wanted to look something up while you were talking there about like his situation in Mexico. Here's how like uniquely kind of difficult of a situation he is in. Ayako isn't wrestling yet, but Xochitl is, and she's wrestling in CMLL. So all this is, while this is all happening, his daughter is already wrestling in one of the promotions. He's not able to get into it.
Okay, that's interesting. I did not realize that.
Yeah, so I forgot when Ayako started, so that's why I was looking, and then I was like, oh wait, no, he had an older daughter, Xochitl. And yeah, no, Xochitl started in 86 when it was working in CMLL in the 90s and left when the CMLL women's division kind of dried up and ended up in AAA, but that was not at a time where her dad was ever really with AAA. So, yeah.
Well, there you go. And that takes us to, and the reason this episode is called Thunderstruck is, of course, because, you know, Liger gets hurt for what was supposed to be either a dream singles match or a dream tag match. But that takes us to the September 29th, 1994 Michinoku Pro Wrestling Show. Like Mike said, this is from Omori. This drew a sellout of 1,681 fans. And I throw it to you, Mike, for your big picture thoughts on a historically significant Michinoku Pro show.
So I think I liked the show a little bit more than you did.
Okay.
But I think that is partially because I have grown enamored with Shinjiro Otani in this phase of his career, which I feel like most people do. I'm just hitting that phase pretty late in life of Otani worship. So
yeah, look, there's a period of Otani's career. It reminds me a little bit of Peak Otani is similar to Peak Ibushi in the sense that I know that the two greatest wrestlers to ever live are not Kota Ibushi and Shinjiro Otani, but when you look at those guys in their peak form doing their best work, it's kind of like, oh, so that's what a pro wrestler should be. Like, those guys
That's exactly what I was going to say about Otani in 95. It's like, oh no, this is a goddamn pro wrestler.
Yeah,
Joe Lanza.
That's like what it should be.
Joe Lanza sees 1995 Shinjiro Otani walk down the street, and even him at like age like 17 will go like, oh, that's a fucking pro wrestler.
he's remarkable. And, you know, he's a guy who, unfortunately, you know, at the current time that we're recording this has just been living a very sad life these past few years because of the incident that he had. But Otani's a fascinating wrestler because he's really good from the jump, and he comes in just at the right time.
I think that's kind of the thing that I'm like really recognizing, is like this guy has come online at a time where New Japan has perhaps its best junior heavyweight division in like 40 years.
Well, because if he comes in, when does he, I gotta look at when he debuts now, this is interesting because I don't remember exactly when. So he debuts in 92, but
Yeah, okay, yeah, he works half 1992. So if he comes in 5 years earlier, there's just no juniors division worth anything for him to be a part of. You know, he ends up like
Hagano, basically.
Yeah, because it's you're dealing with maybe the early days of Liger, but really more so Yamada than Liger, and then, you know, whatever comes of that, you know, Naoki Sano. But if he comes in, let's say, 98, then he's, you know, he's trapped. He's in a really bad era of New Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, his physical peak coincides with the best possible timeline for him as a wrestler. And then when 01 comes about and he puts on a little bit more weight, and one night he loses all of his hair and it just never comes back. It's bizarre how that works. Because you watch Otani in this match with this thick black head of hair and you go, well, obviously this guy has had hair like that forever. Wrong you would be. It one day just went away completely. But
it happens to us sometimes, guys.
A very sensitive subject, I understand. But when he beefs up in 01, it's the perfect time for that, because now he can work with a bit of a beefier Taka and a bit of a beefier Masato Tanaka and obviously Hashimoto and Carino and guys like that. So his two peaks are defined by him just being in the right place at the right time and having the right body for those scenarios as well. But if you've never done the deep dive on 90s Otani, junior heavyweight New Japan Otani, oh my God. I mean, at his peak, he's one of the most enjoyable wrestlers I've ever seen.
Yeah, and I think you talk about like the time period-wise with him. I know that it's just basically taking the time and going through it with him for me, because I know that he has like matches against Kanemoto and Minoru Tanaka, two of my favorite super juniors of all time. So like he does get like the end of that, like he is able to catch that on his way out. So it's just one of those things that he having Otani in for Liger, really, it changes kind of the whole complexion of the show, and also the way that Gaura decided to air this. So it ends up, as we've like talked about how cable television is in the 90s, it ends up that this is 2 1-hour blocks that they had to cut it into cut a wrestling show into two separate episodes of TV. So the actual main event of the show was El Samurai versus Super Delphin, but that's only the main event of the first hour of TV. They put the Sasuke versus Otani match as the actual main event on the second hour of TV.
That's interesting. I did not realize that.
It really threw me off.
I'm
on rails right now, Case. Tunnel vision. So if something is a little off for me, I have to take a moment and go like, why is this way? So, yeah.
I found myself asking this about this entire show. Why is this way? We go from a Michinoku Pro show, an hour of TV that I really enjoyed, to what I thought was largely 2 hours of really boring wrestling. Tell me where I'm wrong here.
Well, I think that if you open up this show and they open this up with Sato and Terry Boy versus Hanzo Nakajima and Hoshikawa, Nahiro Hoshikawa, and you get to see another Kaientai tag. And is it as good as the one that we get with Taka having to be valiantly fight for himself and eventually just kind of collapsing? No, you don't get that. But it is kind of neat to see Hoshikawa kind of moved up into that position and taking a hell of a beating.
Well, it's one of the things that I've pointed out with specifically Nakajima and Hoshikawa, where in my recollection and my viewing of Michinoku Pro prior to doing this podcast, I don't feel like they were ever properly integrated into the core of Michinoku Pro. It always felt like they were kind of off in their own universe. And what's interesting here, and I did not realize this until I put the notes together for this episode, is that at least for this tour, and you can say maybe they hit the eject button too early, or maybe he just didn't live up to the expectation, but Nakajima becomes Sasuke's partner in 1994. You go back to the beginning of the episode, what are we talking about? Mainstream celebrity great Sasuke. And now they've got Nakajima alongside him at the very least for this tour, and it doesn't really seem to stick. It doesn't seem to help. It doesn't seem like it helps Nakajima. You know, here they are integrating him into the roster, And this was a 10-minute match where I was kind of blown away by the work that Kai and Tai did. And there was nothing on the babyface side between Nakajima or Hoshikawa that really grabbed me.
Yeah, and I think that's entirely fair, and that's an issue with this promotion, that it's such a small promotion that they're really, when you had just Delphincore, you could have everyone else versus Delphincore pretty easily, and you can go like, oh yeah, no, Hanzo and Taka with Sasuke against those three, against Nanawa, Shinzaki, and Delphin, right? Like, that was a pretty easy and tried and true main event for them. But splintering it when you only have a roster of KS, I'm just going to go through our notes and just quickly like breeze through them. The native roster, if you include Wilkins, who in all intents and purposes is a native, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 wrestlers. So when you splinter it in half, you have 6 and 6, or really in practice, kind of 4 and 8 was what kind of would end up being, but with just with the beats of the promotion. Now, when you have 12, the guys that you would never think about having to be in the main event or having to team with Sasuke, you kind of have to. And it's just a fact of this promotion being so small at this point, at least with its core native roster.
Well, it goes back to the point you made about the touring schedule earlier. And it's just, it's amazing that anybody held up ever on this roster. You know, it's such a small roster, it feels like there is so much margin for error, and so you find yourself in a position where you do really have to push forward, and you do have to at least try some people out just to shake up the card. And I think the problem with that is that when guys don't work out, and we'll see a little bit of this in 94 and 95, is that when you're lacking depth and the guys you're pushing to the forefront aren't delivering in the way that you'd hope, it really does create a problem.
Yeah, and it's also a situation where Hoshikawa is an odd fit in this promotion to begin with. And Nakajima, although he was able to be, had a strong start as Leopardo Negro, it very quickly showed that he was just a technician, a mechanic without any charisma attached to it. So you're dealing with imperfect parts to begin with, and I think that also hampers it. Terry Boy wearing the headband a week after or 2 weeks afterwards is a real testament. I wonder how much that cut got opened up over those 2 weeks of wrestling.
It's a gnarly cut from the Shinzaki match, the opening match on the last show that we talked about. I mean, it is right over his eye in a really ugly way.
I want to pull up a photo of modern Mintz Tejo and see if you can still see the scar.
Well, to your point about it getting opened up on tour, it's not like he had a day to rest it. You know, he's in the ring every single day after that.
Oh, I have this photo of him in his DDT era that I just pulled up, and there's a huge scar across that eye.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So like that's maybe 20 years after this, like when was Men's Club a thing, really? Like
that feels
late 2000s,
vaguely mid 2000s.
Yeah. So he really got himself good there with it. But yeah, and then you have this aspect of the show, and then a match that I ended up enjoying. But Case, I can see how you're probably pretty that you are lower on it than I am. There ends up being an. It's kind of a shame of what footage we get to kind of build to this. There seems to be kind of a beef between Taka Michinoku and Grand Nanawa that they are kind of butting heads in Delphincore. And they have a singles match that ends up being won by Taka with one of the most fucking brutal clotheslines to the back of the head I've ever seen. And everything seems to be fine afterwards, but apparently there was dissension in Delphincore.
Dissension in Delphincore. This would begin a stretch on this show with the way that the TV was laid out, where we had a number of matches that were really long, jarring singles match length for Michinoku Pro at this point in time, and I don't feel like any of them were as good as they could have been. And this match was slow and repetitive. And I don't think Nanawa brought it, and it was one of the weaker Taka performances we've seen. And it's just it was a trend on this show where I thought everything was flat. So I'll save some of my my verbiage for later, because I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I was not in love with this match.
The thing, there's two things I want to point on, then we can move on with those, because I think you're right about it. This was a dry kind of match. The thing that stood out for me that I ended up liking, Taka's now starting to work with a level of snap that I think he picked up doing those New Japan tours that I feel like kind of reared its head. And it's worth noting, I'm going to run down what this entire card is. I'm not going to give the results, but just so everyone get a frame of reference on how different this show is in comparison to what we're used to with Michinoku Pro. You have Wellington Wilkins versus Yakushiji to open. You have a Jinsei Shinzaki versus Shiryu match after that, that's in the second hour TV. Then you have this tag team match, the Kaintai tag team match. Then it's a singles Taka and Nanawa, Sasuke versus Otani. Main event is Delphin versus El Samurai. I don't think outside of Fukumin tournaments, there will be many shows that will have over on a six match show, five of the matches being singles.
And lengthy singles matches at that too.
Which, in Dave's defense on the point he was making earlier, this does kind of do make you think, okay, the card was shooken up, and instead of doing five matches, which is what they normally had to do, they ended up doing six, which maybe makes me think that they were going to try to do Sasuke and Samurai versus Otani and Delphin as the main event, and they couldn't agree on a finish, so they decided to do two singles.
That could very easily be it.
Because like there's something about this show that, as I'm now looking at a case, that you're absolutely right. It's a weird Michinoku show. And with what happens with Liger, I think that the question has to be asked, how much did Liger's injury really shake up what this card was supposed to be originally? Because you have the three Delphin Corps guys in singles matches instead of doing a match with other people on the roster. You have Kaintai not as a trio when they were working as a trio a lot of the tours. Screams to me the card was shooken up.
Yeah, I buy that line of thinking.
Yeah. So after this, we got the El Samurai backstage promo and a Super Delphin backstage promo. And we had El Samurai versus Super Delphin. Super Delphin finally gets a win with the Delphin clutch, but that's not the story of the match, as Delphin basically spends this match selling the attack that he had at the hands of Kaintai 2 weeks ago. And El Samurai dominates, other than Delphin gets on offense, does two DDTs, does the Delphin clutch, and we're out of here.
It is such a bummer that Samurai does not rise to the occasion. And I found the line of Dave when he talked about Liger's broken leg, about how Liger at that point was already widely considered to be the greatest junior heavyweight in history. And when you see the way that Liger approached the Michinoku Pro relationship, and I'll give Otani credit, because I think the Sasuke match here is okay, but Otani was so unbelievably great in that 8-man tag. You just see some of these guys rise to the occasion, and then you see some of these guys sleepwalk through these appearances, and Samurai brought absolutely nothing to this match.
I've not been a fan of El Samurai and Michinoku Pro or showing up in any of these matches. I feel like out of everyone, out of New Japan, and with a guy who has a history with at least Sasuke working in Mexico at the same time, he seems to have the worst chemistry with everyone. And frankly, he does kind of feel like... given how Otani was previously to the New Japan or to the Michinoku Pro roster case, you would think that he would be the one kind of sleepwalking and not really being with it in the match. But instead, it was El Samurai. And yeah, I thought that this easily was one of the weaker singles matches that Super Delphin has. And I think it's solely because of El Samurai and selling that injury in a way that just... the finish happens and you're like, oh, great, Super Delphin wins. You send the crowd home happy, but you had to sit through 10 minutes of El Samurai kind of just working him over to get to that point.
With no juice.
No juice whatsoever.
Yes.
And that's the end of hour one of the show. The second hour kicks off with Shiryu versus Jinsei Shinzaki. And this one felt more like a Jinsei Shinzaki match than the match he had against Terry Boy. Shinzaki was back to basically being supernatural for me in this one.
Yeah, this is not my favorite of his outings, but still I thought a very strong performance from him specifically.
Notably in this, Shiryu gets out of the first praying powerbomb attempt. He kicks out of a headbutt and a really vicious looking side Russian leg sweep, and it takes the second attempt of the praying powerbomb to put him away. And then the last match that we have from the Junior Nebuta Festival from September 29th, 1994, the main event, at least for Champ Forum, was Shinjiro Otani versus Great Sasuke. Great Sasuke gets the win with the Fire Thunder Powerbomb.
So this is a tale of two matches, because let me look at the match listing here. It goes 21:46. I think we get close to all of that on TV. I think it's very lightly clipped. The first 8 or 9 minutes, Otani looks completely lost in this environment. And I do think it's interesting watching Otani instead of Liger in this spot and just seeing Otani stick out like a sore thumb, because he is black tights, black boots, black hair, Junior, you know, he's Inoki Sito almost, and he really sticks out in Michinoku. It looks very awkward, looks very odd. I think this match starts dreadfully boring. And then by the end, you start to see Otani play the hits, you see Sasuke play the hits, and you have an okay match from there. But this one took a long time to get going.
Yeah, and I felt like that Otani, I think I noticed, like, when he's out of kind of, when he's uncomfortable, he kind of devolves into shark tendencies, and he ended up kind of like eating up Sasuke during like that 7 minutes that I thought was kind of interesting.
Yes, no, completely.
Yeah, but because like the one big thing about Sasuke on this episode, Sasuke decides to do a lot of mat wrestling, and one day maybe he becomes proficient at it, but it is kind of amusing to see Sasuke have to do like 7 minutes of mat reps wrestling with someone who just completely eats him up. And The crowd's there for it, though, so it's okay.
Well, the crowd's there for it, and then by the end, you start to see, I think just through sheer willpower, Sasuke in 1994 not accepting the idea of possibly having a bad match. And so he brings Otani up a level, and I think those two together have a great 6 or 7 minutes. I believe that Ditch used to have this match on his website, but he had it joined in progress. He cut out all the fat at the start. And when you watch the thing in full, like there's some matches that Ditch would edit that way. There specifically is there's a Dragon Gate match. There's a 2 out of 3 falls Triangle Gate match that Ditch cuts out the first 2 falls and just puts the 3rd one in. But when you watch the thing in full, you're like, what are you thinking? This whole match is great. When you watch something like Sasuke versus Otani, you go, wow, I really like the way he cut up that match, because the ending is so much better than the beginning.
Yeah, and you get like little aspects of like Taka's at ringside for this match in the closing moments. You also get the idea of Otani kind of losing it when Sasuke basically last gasp kicks out of the Dragon Suplex. And those were like the moments of it that kind of got me more enamored of Otani, him just going like, I can't believe this is happening to me. Maybe it's just like the idea of putting someone who is, Inoki Sito and put him into like the exact opposite of strong style. And that amuses me and entertains me.
Yeah, just the whole, I mean, you think about the way that Otani presents himself and the way that Otani looks, and then you go back to the last episode we did with Kendo and Superboy and Piloto Suicida and Sasuke being Sasuke, and it's just the dichotomy there is very funny to me.
Yeah, it's like no wonder this guy really had a big issue when Terry Boy showed up, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, after this match, like, Otani seems like he's bawling afterwards. Like, he apoplectically shakes Sasuke's hand. He does a bunch of really pronounced deep bows, and maybe he just kind of at that moment realized that pro wrestling is much more than Inokiism, I guess.
That's a beautiful thing when you come to that realization.
Yeah, I mean, if only Antonio Inoki found that out 20 years before.
Would have been a different world, but nevertheless, that is the Michinoku Pro Show for September 29th, 1994, one that I would label a disappointing one at best. I mean, I would recommend Sasuke versus Otani for the novelty of it. Is there anything that you think people should go out of their way to watch?
I mean, it's cool to see Kai and Tai, especially early Kai and Tai. And if you're watching the match with the idea of seeing them kind of eat up people, that's worth going out of your way for. If you're a Dick Togo fan wanting to see Dick Togo finally start to work heel, absolutely, it's worth that. But it's such a weird show that I don't think the weirdness really sunk in until we started talking about it.
Speaking of Enokiism, we will end with this. We'll go back to New Japan for some observer notes, and then one match that I want to talk about here real quick before we get out of here. We do have the October 25th, 1994 Observer, in which Dave is talking about the Super Junior Tag League, and he writes that the round-robin portion of that Super Junior Tag Tournament ended on 10-15. Going into the final day, Great Sasuke and Black Tiger had finished up the competition with a 5-2 record, while Wild Pegasus and Shinjiro Otani were 4-2, as were Malenko and Ishizawa and Michinoku and Delphin. Honiga and Hamada finished up 4-3, while Two Cold Scorpio and El Samurai were 3-3. Motegi and Kamikaze were 1-6, with their only win coming via forfeit. And Funaki.
There you go, Kamikaze. There you go.
And Funaki and Ishikawa were 0-7, since Funaki suffered a concussion on 10-11, and the team had to forfeit their remaining matches. So Tiger and Sasuke clinched a spot in the final on 10-18, with Malenko and Ishizawa beating Delphin and Michinoku to clinch a final spot, while Otani and Pegasus made it a three-way tie for first, beating Scorpio and Samurai, so they'll be doing a three-team playoff for the championship. The entire week was interesting, this is Dave's writing, in that with the junior heavyweights working with it on top of the card, it meant the usual main eventers went on early, and Tetsumi Fujinami and Riki Choshu even worked tag match openers. The experiment worked again, since every show this week sold out, and interest in the junior league seems to be far more than the heavyweight tournament that starts on 10-19. I will pause here because I think it's worth noting that Liger was the main draw for this tour. A lot of these tickets would have been sold before Liger got injured, but you see a tournament being driven by Sasuke and Black Tiger on top, with Michinoku and Delphin in the mix, is a tournament that is undoubtedly being marked as a commercial success in New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1994, at the same time as a Hashimoto, Fujinami, Choshu, Muto-led promotion, the juniors are equaling them at the box office and outdoing them in terms of interest in the tag tournament.
Yeah, and I think when you really look at where New Japan's divisions were, it's a real credit to the booking of Liger and his willingness to go outside of the sandbox when you contrast that with kind of the stuff that would happen in the heavyweight side. I think that even though all these tickets were kind of sold by Liger, it's really like you've set up a division to have someone that is such a, and it's nothing to speak ill of the guy, but in the greater schemes of things, such a complete zero, like Norio Hanagawa being the injury champion, and things are just completely off to the races without Liger when you look at the kind of matches that they would have and just the general state of that division. What company's division would you want to take more in 1994, given what we've seen? I think I would take New Japan's junior heavyweight division over anywhere else in the world at that time.
Yeah, the only competition I think would be the AAA roster, or I mean, if you really love the high end stuff from All Japan, but there's a level of depth in that juniors division that is spectacular. I mean, it's the kind of depth that was really only seen maybe 20 years later, that 2015 to 2017 New Japan Juniors division, when you would have the Bucks and O'Reilly and Fish, and then the emergence of Osprey and, you know, Mascara Dorada, Kushida, guys like that. But it's a very rare thing for a juniors division to be that loaded, which is what Dave writes about in the October 17th, 1994 Wrestling Observer newsletter. He does a very in-depth look on the Puro scene at large. I would highly recommend going back and reading that if that sounds interesting to you. And in the New Japan section, he writes, New Japan shines in the junior heavyweight division with a crew that is led by the now injured Jushin Thunder Liger, probably the best of all time in that division, the solid and underrated El Samurai, future superstar Shinjiro Otani, and some great foreign regulars led by Wild Pegasus, Black Tiger, and Dean Malenko. In addition, the division is augmented by wrestlers from smaller groups, in particular Michinoku Pro, Super Delphin, and Great Sasuke, the latter of whom has become something of a mainstream celebrity this year. Its J-Cup tournament on 4/16 was probably the best wrestling show of the year, and its annual January 4th show at the Tokyo Dome, with both its history and gate success, ranks with WrestleMania as the biggest wrestling show on any given year.
Yeah, it's really, when you like take a stock, when you take stock of it, they've really, Liger, if there was a way to go into the into Hall of Fames as a wrestler and then also as a booker, I think 94 is his argument for that, you know?
Let me steal a phrase from a fellow podcaster. When Bill Simmons every once in a while talks about an actor's apex mountain, you know, the very peak of his career, is 94 what we would mark as Liger's apex mountain?
I think he saw some stuff in 95 that is still at that level.
But
you
think
know?
About think about the power that he was able to yeah. wield this year, where he creates the J Cup, he sells it out in advance, it becomes one of the greatest shows of all time. He then is able to forge a relationship with Michinoku Pro, which would be like a record label signing an indie band with a ton of buzz. He's able to form a working relationship there. He's phenomenal in the ring, and he's phenomenal behind the scenes. He might have great other years. I mean, look, 2003 Liger working Noah is or I guess 2002 Liger working Noah is one of my favorite wrestlers to ever exist. But in terms of him at the peak of his powers on and off screen, yeah, it might be 1994.
Yeah, no, I think you sold me on it. And that leads us to the last match that we have for this. It's the finals of the Super Junior, or I'm sorry, the Super Gray Junior Heavyweight Tag League Finals between the teams of Black Tiger 2 and the Great Sasuke versus Wild Pegasus and Shinjiro Otani. Case, this is not going to be a big shock. This is easily the best match of the episode that we have. And honestly, when I was talking about really falling into Otani, this was the match where I was just like, God, they made the guy in this match. And he felt like an absolute killer coming out of it.
Dave has this 4.75. I would not have it that high, but I put it in here because I do think it is essential viewing because you're once again.
I had it 4.25.
Okay, so did I. That's where I would have it as well. And I think it's notable because, again, you have the Otani performance, which is notable because as we move along here into 1995, it's not like Pegasus and Tiger are going to hang around New Japan all that much longer, so they need to restock the pond, which is another credit to Liger for sort of. I guess Pegasus is there. I take that back. He works all of 95. I didn't realize he was in New Japan that long. Wow.
Yeah, no. I think he makes the Dome in 96, and that's it.
Wow. I thought he was out at the end of 94. He's out at the end of 95. But anyways, it always helps to have another guy in the mix. They get that guy with Otani there. And it's also Sasuke headlining a show. I mean, this is the Okayama Prefectorial Gymnasium. 4,000 people, sold out, 10-18-94. And you see Sasuke in the ring with people that we consider to be historical all-time greats, you know, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, Shinjiro Otani, and Sasuke's right there doing the damn thing and doing it quite well.
Yeah, given his performances across the year, I know that he peaks much higher during Super J Cup, and that's just one of those things that there are certain nights that people are able to ascend to godhood in pro wrestling, and that was the night that he ascended. But this one felt like a lot smoother one. Like, we always know that that Sasuke, there will be a crash and burn factor out of it. But I mean, you look at where he was basically 6 months after Super J Cup and where he was at Super J Cup, and he's much more a refined major league pro wrestler at this point.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a really well-rounded Sasuke performance that, given what we normally get from him, is less exciting than normal because he rarely cheats death, which is just a strange occurrence for him.
Yeah, no. It's just like, and it works in the match because when he goes for the quebrada, the crowd just loses it at that point. Like, in a lot of ways, like, we, especially with the match with Liger, like, we saw the amount of crash and burn in the crowd dialing into it. I think you gave them the big taste. Now you make them pay for it, and you make them sit through 15 minutes before you get the Sasuke crash and burns. I think that shows a much more remarkably refined wrestler, and I can't believe I'm actually saying that sentence about great Sasuke.
Yeah, look, it's less refined than some all-time greats would ever be, but there is something really to that, and I think that's this is a very good match to look at the evolution of Sasuke. You think about what he's doing at the end of 93 with Otani or I'm sorry, with Onita compared to what he's doing now at the end of 94. From a career perspective and the stature that he rose to, and then also just from the way that he presented himself as a wrestler, it's why we're doing this series, is to highlight things like that. And Sasuke's 1994 is his apex mountain. You know, we'll finish up 1994 in the next episode, just to not jump ahead too quick, but it's a very special year for Sasuke, and I think that's why this match needs to be in our match listing. If you get the chance, Mike, because I don't think you did this, the semifinal match is Tiger and Sasuke versus Hamada and Hanaga. Worth watching as well.
All right, I'll hunt that one down. But yeah, and you get a level of inventiveness in this match that I don't think you get to see in New Japan in 1994, too. That is worth going and seeing. I mean, there was a wild... this match was kind of built around Doomsday moves, and the reaction of the crowd, first for like just Doomsday drop kicks, and then in the closing stretch, they turn what might have been one of the first like Doomsday to Harris that I have seen, at least like thinking like 1994, and instead Black Tiger turns it into a power bomb for near fall, going into a stretch where Otani gets the win over Tiger with the Dragon Suplex hold. And for 1994, this is a, in 2025 eyes, a remarkably modern kind of closing stretch for a junior heavyweight match.
I agree. And there's a few of these spots, these really high risk spots, that I don't know if they go the way that they were planning on it. There's some gnarly, gnarly bumps in this match, but everybody makes it out alive. Everybody makes it out. And it is
for
really,
then, Case. For then.
For then.
Sorry.
Really a quite exciting match when you look at some of those big bumps. But we know the long term ramifications, not ideal.
I mean, Sasuke is still here.
Oh, yeah. He's a real normal, well-adjusted guy.
Yeah. When he's the one that you point to as the good one, with like,
Jesus,
I did not mean to go that dark there.
No. It was worth it. It's the end of the episode. Why not?
But next week or next edition of Those Days, Case.
It's a loaded one.
It's an episode that I've been waiting for, and I think I was expecting to happen a lot sooner than this, Case. Give the folks at home a preview.
So next time on Those Days, we will finally get into it. Sasuke versus Onita, double hell death match. We will break down that with excerpts from Great Sasuke's book and his thoughts on that match. We will also go to All Japan Women and break down the Michinoku Pro 6-man tag there. We will briefly talk about Hakushi's WWF TV debut. And then we will close out 1994 with two episodes of Michinoku Pro TV. A lot of footage will be watched between now and when we record that episode, and it is all stuff that I am very, very excited about.
Just the preview stuff that I have seen that Sasuke has done to build up this match is incredible. Like I've been waiting to post the Sasuke helicopter clip for months now.
It's an all-timer,
and that will be next time on Those Days. If you would like to support Open the Voice Gate, you can do that on social media. We are on both Twitter and Blue Sky at Open Voice Gate. If you would like to donate to the show, just being completely frank, the money that gets donated goes straight into things that we do for Those Days. I have some stuff that I was able to do that we will be bringing for future episodes of Those Days that was brought to you by the donation. So thank y'all for those as well. If you want to join the conversation, the best place to do it is at the Voices of Wrestling Discord. There is a Dragon Gate channel for Open the Voice Gate. If you are listening to this far and don't know that we are normally a Dragon Gate podcast, we have the Dragon Gate section there, but also the Open the Voice Gate channel. That's where, especially for Those Days episodes, we will have all of the match listings posted there with links, and as well any other notes and discussions going on there. But next time we will be back to talk about Sasuke versus Onita, double hell death match. Take care, everyone.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now, you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Wrestling Omakase is back, baby. The weekly podcast that takes you across all the top promotions on the entire Japanese wrestling scene, from New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, DDT, All Japan, Marigold, Dragon Gate, Tokyo Joshi, Sendai Girls, and a whole lot more. I'm John Carroll, a fan of Japanese wrestling for over 20 years, and every week I'm joined by a rotating cast of guest co-hosts as we break down all the top promotions in Japan, men's and women's. Check out Wrestling Omakase right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network today.